The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 1, Continued.
Cassette 1, Side 2. The glaciers came and went. The granite boulders littered the shores of the lakes. The lakes froze during the winter nights. The sea howled under the wind and was covered with an icy sludge, and in places froze. The northern lights blazed across half the sky. And it grew bright once again, and warm once again, and the fir trees grew and thickened, and the birds cackled and called, and the young deer trumpeted, and the planets circled through all world history, and kingdoms fell and rose, and here there were still no beasts of prey, and no human being. Sometimes the men of Novgorod landed there, and they counted the islands as belonging to their Obonezhskaya Pyatina. Karelians lived there, too. Half a hundred years after the Battle of Kulikovo Field, and half a thousand years before the GPU, the monks, Savati and German, crossed the Mother of Pearl Sea in a tiny boat, and came to look on this island, without a beast of prey, as sacred. The Solovetsky Monastery began with them. After that, the cathedrals of the Assumption and of the Transfiguration arose. The Church of the Beheading on Sekirnaya Hill, and another score of churches, and another score of bell towers, and the smaller monasteries of Golgotha, the Trinity, Sabachevsky, and Muksalmsky, and solitary retreats of hermits and ascetics in the remote locations. The labor of many went into the creation of all this, first of the monks themselves, and subsequently of the peasants belonging to the monastery. The lakes were joined by dozens of canals. Lake water was delivered to the monastery by wooden pipes. And the most surprising thing of all was a dike at Muksalma, 19th century, made from immovable boulders somehow set in place on the sand spits. On large and small Muksalma, fat herds began to pasture. The monks loved to tend animals, both tame and wild. The Solovetsky land turned out to be not only holy, but rich, too, capable of feeding many thousands. Specialists in the history of technology say that back in the 16th century, Philip Kolyachev, who had raised his voice against Ivan the Terrible, introduced a system of agricultural technology at Solovki that even three centuries later would have been respectable anywhere. In the vegetable gardens they raised plump, firm, sweet white cabbages. The stalks were called Solovetsky apples. All their vegetables were their own, and all of them were of the best quality. And they had their own greenhouses for flowers, where they even raised roses. They developed fisheries, catch from the sea and from the metropolitan's fish ponds dammed off from the sea. In the course of centuries and decades, they acquired their own mills to mill their own grain, their own sawmills, their own dishware made in their own pottery works, their own foundry, their own smithy, their own bindery, their own leather shop, their own carriage shop, and even their own electric power station. Even their elaborately shaped bricks and their sea-going boats for their own use, they made all themselves. However, no development ever took place in the past, nor takes place in the present, and it isn't clear that it will ever take place in the future, without being accompanied by military thought and prison thought. Military thought. It was impermissible for some sort of feckless monks just to live on just an island. The island was on the borders of the great empire, and consequently it was required to fight with the Swedes, the Danes, the English, and consequently it was required to build a fortress with walls 8 yards thick, and to raise up 8 towers on the walls, and to make narrow embrasures in them, and to provide for a vigilant watch from the cathedral bell tower. And the monastery did have to defend itself against the English in 1808, and in 1854, and emerged unconquered. And in the conflict with the supporters of the Patriarch Nikon in 1667, the monk, Feoktist, opened a secret entrance and betrayed the Solovetsky Kremlin to a boyar of the Tsar. Prison thought. How glorious. Good stone walls standing on a separate island. What a good place to confine important criminals. And with someone already there to provide guard. We won't interfere with their saving their souls. Just guard our prisoners. How much of humanity's faith was destroyed by this double duty of Christian monasteries as prisons? Had Savati thought about that when he landed on the Holy Island? They imprisoned church heretics here, and political heretics as well. For example, Avrami Palitsin was imprisoned here. He died here. And Pushkin's uncle, P. Ganibal, for his support of the Decembrists. And the last ataman of the Zaporozhye Cossacks, Konyashevsky, a distant predecessor of Petliura, when he was already a very old man, was imprisoned here. And he was over 100 years old when he was released after serving a long term. The state prison in Solovki existed from 1718 on. Visiting Solovki in the 80s of the 19th century, the commander of the armies of the St. Petersburg military district, Grand Duke Vladimir Alexandrovich, found the military garrison there superfluous, and he removed all the soldiers from Solovki. In 1903, the Solovetsky prison ceased to exist. Incidentally, the ancient history of the Solovetsky monastery prison was the victim of a fashionable myth, disseminated only in Soviet times, during the period of the Soviet prison camp on Solovki, which deceived the writers of guidebooks and historical descriptions. And nowadays one can read in several books that the Solovetsky prison was a torture prison, that it had hooks for the rack and lashes and torture with fire. But all these were the appurtenances of interrogation prisons in the era before Empress Elizabeth, or of the Western Inquisition, and were not at all typical of Russian monastery dungeons in general, and were dreamed up here by an unscrupulous and also ignorant investigator. The old Solovetsky Island people remember him very well. It was the joker Ivanov who bore the camp nickname of the anti-religious germ. Formerly, he had been a lay brother attached to the Novgorod archbishopric, arrested for selling church valuables to the Swedes. He got to Solovki in 1925 and hustled about to escape general work and death. He had made anti-religious propaganda among the prisoners his specialty, and of course became a collaborator of the ISCH, the Information and Investigation Section, which was named very candidly. But in addition, he excited the heads of the camp with his suggestions that many treasures had been buried here by the monks, and so they created a commission for excavations under his leadership. This commission kept on digging many months. But alas, the monks had cheated the psychological calculations of the anti-religious germ. They had buried no treasures in Solovki. At this point, to get out of the situation with honor, Ivanov went around explaining the underground workshops, storehouse, and defense installations as prison and torture facilities. The torture instruments naturally could not be preserved so many centuries, but the hooks, of course, for hanging up carcasses, were evidence that there had been a rack here. It was more difficult to provide a basis for the finding that no trace of 19th century torture had survived, so the conclusion was reached that during the past century the regime in the Solovetsky prison had been significantly relaxed. The discoveries of the anti-religious germ had come right at the most appropriate time, had in some degree reassured the disappointed administration, and were published in the Solovetsky Islands, and subsequently as a monograph in the Solovetsky printing shop, and by this means successfully muddied the waters of historical truth. This whole intrigue was judged all the more appropriate because the flourishing Solovetsky monastery had been very famous and respected in all Russia, up to the time of the revolution. But when power passed into the hands of the workers, what was to be done with these malevolent, parasitical monks? They sent commissars, socially tried and true leaders, and they proclaimed the monastery a state farm, and ordered the monks to pray less and to work harder for the benefit of the workers and peasants. The monks worked, and their herring, which was astonishing in its flavour, and which they had been able to catch because of their special knowledge of where and when to cast nets, was shipped off to Moscow to be used for the Kremlin tables. However, the abundance of valuables concentrated in the monastery, especially in the sacristy, troubled some of the leaders and overseers who had arrived there. Instead of passing into the workers' hands, that is, their own, these valuables lay there as a dead religious burden. And at that point, contradicting to a certain degree the criminal code, but corresponding in a very genuine way with the general spirit of expropriation of the property of non-workers, the monastery was set on fire, on May the 25th, 1923. The buildings were damaged, and many valuables disappeared from the sacristy. And, the principal thing, all the inventory records burned up, and it was quite impossible to determine how much and exactly what had disappeared. And the anti-religious germ also referred to this fire, explaining the difficulty in finding nowadays material proofs of the former prison cells and torture apparatus. But without even conducting an investigation, what is our revolutionary sense of justice, sense of smell, going to hint to us? Who, if not the black gang of monks themselves, could have been to blame for the arson of the monastery wealth? So, throw them out onto the mainland and concentrate all the northern special-purpose camps on the Solovetsky Islands. The 80-year-old and even 100-year-old monks begged on their knees to be allowed to die on the holy soil, but they were all thrown out with proletarian ruthlessness, except for the most necessary among them, the artels of fishermen. They removed the fishermen from Solovki about 1930, and from that date on, the herring catches came to an end. No one could manage to find that particular herring in the sea anymore, and it was as if it had completely disappeared. The cattle specialists on Muksalma, Father Methodius, the cabbage sorter, Father Sampson, the foundry specialist, yes, and other such useful fathers as well. They were allotted a corner of the Kremlin separate from the camp, with their own exit, the herring gates. They were christened a workers' commune, but out of condescension for their total stupefaction, they were left for their prayers, the Onufriev Church at the cemetery. And that is how one of the favorite sayings constantly repeated by the prisoners came true. A holy place is never empty. The chimes of bells fell silent, the icon lamps and the candle stands fell dark. The liturgies and the vespers resounded no longer. Psalms were no longer chanted around the clock. The iconostases were wrecked, though they left the one in the Cathedral of the Transfiguration. But on the other hand, courageous Czechists, in overcoats with super-long flaps which reached all the way down to the heels, and particularly distinctive black Solovetsky cuffs and lapels, and black-edged service caps without stars, arrived there in June 1923, to set up a model camp, a model of severity, the pride of the Workers' and Peasants' Republic. Whatever special purpose might mean had not yet been formulated and set forth in instructions, but they had, of course, explained this orally at the Lubyanka to the chief of the Solovetsky camp, Eichmanns, and he, on arriving at the islands himself, had explained it to his closest assistant. Nowadays, you could not astonish former zecs or even just plain people of the 60s with the story of Solovki. But just let the reader imagine to himself, if he will, a person of Chekhov's and post-Chekhov Russia, a person of the Silver Age of our culture, as they called the decade after 1910, brought up then, a bit shaken up by the Civil War, no doubt, but nonetheless accustomed to the kind of food, clothing, and mutual verbal communication customary among human beings. And then and there he enters the gates of Solovki, Kemperpunkt, the Kem transit camp. In Finnish, this place is called Vegaraksha, that is, the habitation of witches. This transit camp in Kem was barren, without tree or bush, Popov Island, joined to the mainland by a dike. And the first thing he would see in that naked, dirty pen would be a quarantine company, for they organized the prisoners there in companies, they had not yet discovered the brigade, dressed in sacks, just ordinary sacks, the legs stuck out down below as if from under a skirt, and though holes for head and arms, impossible to imagine something like that, but what is there that our Russian ingenuity cannot overcome? This sack the newcomer would avoid as long as he had his own clothes, but before he had even managed to examine those sacks well, he would see the legendary Captain Kurilko. Kurilko, or Beloborodov, interchangeable with him, also came out to the prisoner transport column in a long Czechist overcoat with those frightening black cuffs which looked so utterly outlandish against the background of the old Russian khaki, like a herald of death. He jumped up on a barrel or some other suitable elevation, and he spoke to the new arrivals with unexpectedly strident rage. Hey, attention! Here the Republic is not Sovietskaya, but Solovetskaya. Get this straight. No prosecutor has ever set foot on Solovetsky soil, and none ever will. Learn one thing. You have not been sent here for correction. You can't straighten out a hunchback. The system will be this. When I say stand up, you stand up. When I say lie down, you lie down. Your letters home are going to read like this. I'm alive, healthy, and satisfied with everything. Period. Struck dumb with astonishment, famous noblemen, intellectuals from the capital, priests, mullahs, and dark Central Asians listened to him and heard such things as had never before been heard or seen or read. And Kurilko, who had never made a splash during the Civil War, but who now, by this particular historical method, was writing his name in the chronicle of all Russia, got more and more worked up by each successful shout and turn of phrase, and kept formulating and spontaneously sharpening up still other new ones. And so, vainglorious and in full cry, and thinking maliciously inside himself, you prisoners, where were you hiding when we were fighting against the Bolsheviks? You thought you could sit the whole thing out in your nooks and crannies, and now they've dragged you here? So, that's for your shitty neutrality. And I'm friends with the Bolsheviks. We are people of deeds. Kurilko would begin his exercises. Hello, first quarantine company. That's bad. It's not loud enough. Once more. Hello, first quarantine company. That's not loud enough. You have got to shout, hello, so loud that they can hear you over there on Solovki across the bay. When 200 men shout, the walls have got to fall down. Once again, hello, first quarantine company. Making sure that everyone was shouting at the top of his lungs and was ready to fall in his tracks, exhausted by shouting, Kurilko began his new exercise. The quarantine company was to run around a post. Legs higher, legs higher! He was having hard going himself by now, like a tragedian before the final murder in the fifth act. And in the last hoarse croak of his half-hour of instruction, as a confession of the essence of Solovki, he promised those falling and those fallen, already prostrate on the ground, I'll make you suck the snot from corpses. And that was just the first training session, intended to break the will of the newly arrived prisoners. And in the black, wooden, rotten, stinking barracks, they would be ordered to sleep on their sides, which wasn't so bad either, because that was for those prisoners whom the squad leaders would squeeze onto the bunks for a bribe, and all the rest would stand between the bunks all night, and anyone guilty of an offence would be set to stand, furthermore, between the latrine barrel and the wall. And these were the blessed years of 1923 and 1925, before the great turning point, before the personality cult, before the distortions, before the violations. And from 1927 on, there was this in addition, that Urki, thieves, would already be lying there on the bunks and snapping the lice off themselves into the midst of the standing intellectuals. While waiting for the steamship Gleb Boki, they worked at the Chem transit camp, and some of them might be compelled to run around the post, hollering incessantly, I'm a sponger, I don't want to work, and I get in the way of the others. The Gleb Boki was named in honor of the chairman of the Moscow Troika of the OGPU, a young man who never finished his studies. He was a student, he was a mining student, but passing marks just never came. This was a friendly epigram which appeared in the magazine Solovetskie Ostrova. The censor was stupid, and he didn't understand what he had passed. And an engineer who fell off the latrine barrel and spilled it on himself was not allowed in the barracks and was left outside to freeze in all his sewage. And sometimes the convoy would shout, No laggards in the group! The convoy shoots without warning! Forward march! And then, sliding the bolts of their rifles into position, You trying to bug us? And in the winter they would chase them out on the ice on foot, forcing them to drag the boats behind them and row across patches of water, and then, in open water, they would load them into the steamship's hold and shove so many in that before getting to Solovki, several of them would certainly die without ever seeing the snowy white monastery inside the brown walls. In his very first Solovetsky hours, the newcomer might well experience the Solovetsky reception bath trick. He has already undressed, and the first bath attendant dips a swab into a cask of green soap and swabs the newcomer. The second one boots him somewhere down below, down an inclined board or a flight of stairs. Down there, a third bath attendant lets him, still confused, have a whole bucketful. And a fourth, right off, shoves him out into the dressing room, where his rags have already been tossed down from above, however they happen to land. In this joke, one can foresee all gulag, both its tempo and the price of a human being. And that is how the newcomer swallowed the Solovetsky spirit. A spirit still unknown in the country as a whole, but which represented the future spirit of the archipelago created at Solovki. And here, too, the newcomer would see people in sacks, and also in ordinary free clothing, new on some and tattered on others, and in the special Solovetsky short pea jacket made from coat material. This was a privilege. This was a sign of high position. That was how the camp administrative personnel dressed. With the so-called Solovchanki caps, made from the same kind of cloth. And suddenly you would see a person walking about among the prisoners in formal tail coat, and no one was surprised. No one turned around to look at him and laugh. After all, everyone came wearing what was his own. This poor chap had been arrested in the Metropole restaurant, and so there he was, slogging out his sentence in his tailcoat. The magazine, the Solovetsky Islands, 1930 number one, declared it was the dream of many prisoners to receive standard clothing. All values turn upside down with the years, and what was considered a privilege in the special purpose camp of the 20s to wear government-issue clothing would become an annoyance in the special camp of the 40s. There, the privilege would be not to wear government-issue clothing, but to wear at least something of one's own, even just a cap. The reason here was not economic only, but it was a cry of the whole epoch. One decade saw as its ideal how to join in the common lot, and the other how to get away from it. Only the children's colony was completely dressed. And the women, for example, were given neither underwear nor stockings nor even kerchiefs to cover their heads. They had grabbed the old biddy in a summer dress. She just had to go on wearing it the whole Arctic winter. Because of this, many prisoners remained in their company quarters in nothing but their underwear, and no one chased them out to work. Government-issue clothing was so precious that no one on Solovki found the following scene either astonishing or weird. In the middle of winter, a prisoner undressed and took his shoes off near the Kremlin, then carefully handed in his uniform and ran naked for 200 yards to another group of people where he was given clothes to put on. This meant that he was being transferred from the Kremlin administration to the administration of the Filimonovo branch railroad. They had dragged the railroad from Staraya Russa to Novgorod all the way over here. But if he had been transferred wearing clothes, those taking him over might not have returned the clothes or have cheated by switching them. And here is another winter scene. The same customs, though the reason is different. The medical section infirmary is found to be infectious, and orders are issued to scald it down and wash it out with boiling water. But where are the sick prisoners to be put in the meanwhile? All the Kremlin accommodations are overcrowded. The density of the population of the Solovetsky archipelago is greater than that of Belgium. So what must it be like in the Solovetsky Kremlin? And therefore, all the sick prisoners are carried out on blankets and laid out on the snow for 3 hours. When they have washed out the infirmary, they haul the patients in again. We have not forgotten, I hope, that our newcomer is a child of the Silver Age. He knows nothing of the Second World War or of Buchenwald. What he sees is this. The squad leaders in khaki pea jackets, stiffly erect, greet one another and the company leaders with salutes. And then they drive their workers out with long clubs, with staves. And there is even a special verb which everyone understands, meaning to stave. He sees that sledges and carts are drawn not by horses, but by men, several harnessed into one rig. And there is also another word, vridlo, an acronym meaning a temporary replacement for a horse. And from other Solovetsky inhabitants he learns things more awful than his eyes perceive. People pronounce the fatal word Serkirka to him. This means Sekirnaya Hill. punishment cells were set up in the two-story cathedral there. And here is how they kept prisoners in the punishment cells. Poles, the thickness of an arm, were set from wall to wall, and prisoners were ordered to sit on these poles all day. At night they lay on the floor, one on top of another, because it was overcrowded. The height of the poles was set so that one's feet could not reach the ground, and it was not so easy to keep balance. In fact, the prisoner spent the entire day just trying to maintain his perch. If he fell, the jailers jumped in and beat him. Or else they took him outside to a flight of stairs consisting of 365 steep steps from the cathedral to the lake, just as the monks had built it. They tied the person lengthwise to a balan, a beam, for the added weight, and rolled him down, and there wasn't even one landing, and the steps were so steep that the log with the human being on it would go all the way down without stopping. Well, after all, for poles, you didn't have to go to Serkirka. They were right there in the Kremlin punishment block, which was always overcrowded. Or they might put the prisoners on a sharp-edged boulder, on which one could not stay long either. Or, in summer, on the stump, which meant naked among the mosquitoes. But in that event, one had to keep an eye on the culprit, whereas if he was bound naked to a tree, the mosquitoes would look after things themselves. And then they could put whole companies out in the snow for disobedience. Or they might drive a person into the marsh muck up to his neck and keep him there. And then there was another way, to hitch up a horse in empty shafts and fasten the culprit's legs to the shafts. Then the guard mounted the horse and kept on driving the horse through a forest cut until the groans and the cries from behind simply came to an end. Before even beginning his life on Solovki, the novice was oppressed in his spirit simply by the fact of his endless 3-year term. But the contemporary reader would be much too hasty if he concluded that this was an open and above-board system of destruction, of death camps. Oh no, we are not so simple. In that first experimental camp, as in others afterward, and in the most comprehensive of them all, we never act openly. It is all mixed up, layer upon layer, and that is why it is so long-lasting and so successful. All of a sudden, through the Kremlin gates rode some daredevil astride a goat. He bore himself with importance, and no one laughed at him. Who was it, and why was he on a goat? This was Degtyarov. In the past, he had been a cowboy. Not to be confused with the three Degtyarov, the chief of troops of the Solovetsky Archipelago. He had asked for a horse, but there were few horses on Solovki, so they gave him a goat. What had he done to deserve the honor? Because he had been a cowboy? No, not at all, because he was the manager of the dendrological nursery. He grew exotic trees, here, on Solovki. And so it was that from this horseman on a goat there arose a Solovetsky fantasy. Why should there be exotic trees on Solovki, where even the simple and reasonable vegetable economy of the monks had been destroyed, and where the vegetables were running out? Well, they were there because exotic trees at the Arctic Circle meant that Solovki, like the entire Soviet Republic, was remaking the world and building a new life. But where did the seeds and the funds come from? That's exactly the point. There was money for seeds for the dendrological nursery. There just wasn't any money for feeding the logging crews, where food was provided not according to norms, but according to available funds. And as for archaeological excavations, yes, we have a commission for excavations. It is important for us to know our past. In front of the camp administration building was a flower bed. In it was outlined a friendly elephant, the acronym for Solovetsky Special Purpose Camp, being S-L-O-N, elephant. On the blanket on the elephant's back was the letter U, standing for administration. And that very same rebus was on the Solovetsky coupons which circulated as the currency of this northern state. What a pleasant, cozy little masquerade. So it would seem that everything was really very nice here, that practical joker Kurilka had only been trying to throw a scare into us for nothing. And then, too, the camp had its own magazine, also called Slon. The first numbers came out in 1924, typed, and from issue number 9 on it was printed in the monastery printing shop. From 1925 on, the Solovetsky Islands had been published in 200 copies and had its own supplement. The newspaper Novye Solovki, new Solovki. We shall break with our accursed monastery past. And from 1926 on, subscriptions were accepted from the entire Soviet Union, and the run was a large one, and it was a big success. And almost immediately it was broken off. The regime showed it was not in such a joking mood. In 1929, after the big events on Solovki and a general turn in all camps in the direction of re-education, the magazine was started up once again and appeared until 1932. Censorship of the magazine was evidently superficial. The prisoners, according to Glubokovsky, wrote joking verses about the GPU Troika, and they were passed. And then they were sung from the stage of the Solovetsky Theatre, right in front of Troika chairman Gleb Boki himself. They promised us gifts, a bag full, Boki, Feldman, Vasilyev, and Vull. And this bigwig liked it. Well, after all, it was flattering. You hadn't even finished school, and here you were, going down in history. Then the chorus. All those who rewarded us with Solovki we do invite. Come take your leisure. Sit here with us for three or five. You'll always remember them with pleasure. They roared. They liked it. Who was there to figure out that this was a prophecy? And impudent Shepchinsky, the son of a general who had been shot, then hung a slogan over the entrance gates. Solovki, for the workers and peasants! And this, too, was a prophecy after all. But it didn't go over well. They figured this one out and they took it down. The actors of the dramatics troupe wore costumes made out of church vestments. They presented The Rails Hum. There were affected fox-trotting couples on the stage, The Dying West, and a victorious red forge painted on the backdrop, Us. It was a fantastic world. No, that scoundrel Kurilko had just been joking. And then there was also the Solovetsky Society for Local Law, which published reports and researches, for instance, about the unique 16th century architecture or the Solovetsky fauna, and they wrote in such detail and with such scholarly devotion, with such a gentle love for their subject, that it really seemed as if these idle, eccentric scholars had come to the island because of their passion for knowledge, not as prisoners who had already passed through the Lubyanka and who were trembling lest they end up on Sekernaya Hill or out under mosquitoes, or fastened to the empty shaft behind a horse. Yes, the very Solovetsky beasts and birds, in keeping with the spirit of the students of local law, had not yet died out, had not been shot or expelled, were not even frightened. Even as late as 1928, a whole trusting brood of hares would come right up to the very edge of the road and watch with curiosity the prisoners being led off to Anzer. How had it happened that the hares had not been exterminated? They would explain it to the newcomer this way. The little beasts and birds are not afraid here because there is a GPU order in effect. Save ammunition. Not a single shot is to be fired except at a prisoner. So all the scares were just a joke. But a shout comes in broad daylight in the Kremlin yard where prisoners are crowded as thick as on Nevsky Prospect. Make way! Make way! And three foppish young men with the faces of junkies. The lead man drives back the crowd of prisoners not with a club, but with a riding crop. Drag along swiftly by the shoulders, a prisoner with limp arms and legs, dressed only in his underwear. His face is horrible, flowing like liquid. They drag him off beneath the bell tower. They squeeze him through that little door and shoot him in the back of the head. Steep stairs lead down inside, and he tumbles down them, and they can pile up as many as 7 or 8 men in there, and then send men to drag out the corpses, and detail women, mothers and wives of men who have emigrated to Constantinople, and religious believers who refuse to recant their faith and to allow their children to be torn from it, to wash down the steps. And right now, there on the stones over which they dragged them, in that part of the courtyard secluded from the Solovetsky wind, cheerful tourists who have come to see the notorious islands sock a volleyball hours at a time. They do not know. Well, and if they did know, they would go on socking anyway. But why like this? Couldn't they have done it at night, quietly? But why do it quietly? In that case, a bullet would be wasted. In the daytime crowd, the bullet had an educational function. It, so to speak, struck down 10 with one shot. They shot them in a different way, too, right at the Onufriev Cemetery, behind the women's barracks, the former guest house for women pilgrims. And in fact, that road past the women's barracks was christened Execution Road. In winter, one could see a man being led barefoot along it in only his underwear, through the snow. No, it was not for torture, it was just so his footgear and clothes should not go to waste. His hands bound behind his back with wire, a Solovetsky method which strangely was repeated with corpses at Katyn Forest. Someone remembered, a matter perhaps of tradition, or was it personal experience? And the condemned man would bear himself proudly and erectly, and with his lips alone, without the help of his hands, smoke the last cigarette of his life. This was how you recognized an officer. After all, these were men who had gone through 7 years on different fronts. There was an 18-year-old youth, the son of the historian V.A. Poto, who, when he was asked his profession by a work assigner, replied with a shrug of the shoulders, "Machine gunner." Because of his youth in the heat of the Civil War, he had never managed to acquire any other. A fantastic world, and that's the way it is sometimes. Much in history repeats itself, but there also exist completely unique combinations, brief in duration and limited in place. One such example was our new economic policy, the NEP, and another was early Solovki. There weren't many Czechists there at all. Yes, and those who were may well have been in semi-punishment status. No more than 20 to 40 people held sway over thousands, many thousands. At the very beginning, they hadn't expected so many, but Moscow kept sending and sending and sending. In the first half year, by December 1923, there were already 2,000 prisoners gathered there. And in 1928, in the 13th Company alone, the General Work Company, the last in formation on count-off would announce, "The 376th, 10 in the unit." And what that added up to was 3,760 men, and the 12th Company was just as large, and the 17th, which dug mass graves in the cemetery, was even bigger. And in addition to the Kremlin companies, there were already others in Komandirovki, temporary work parties, Savatievo, Filimonovo, Mukshalma, Trinity, and Zaychiki, the Zayatsky Island. By 1928, there were altogether about 60,000. And how many among them were machine gunners, veteran soldiers with long service records? And in 1926, the inveterate, habitual criminal element of all sorts began to flood in. And how were they all to be kept in check, kept from rebelling? Only by terror. Only with Sekhernaya Hill. With poles. With mosquitoes. By being dragged through stumps. By daytime executions. Moscow kept pushing out prisoner transports without taking into consideration local forces, but neither did Moscow set limitations on its Czechists by hypocritical rules. Everything done to maintain order was a fait accompli, and it was really true that no prosecutor would set foot on Solovetsky soil. And the second method was a gauze veil with a fringe, the era of equality, and new Solovki. Self-guarding by the prisoners, self-supervision, self-verification, company commanders, platoon commanders, squad leaders, all from among the prisoners themselves, and their own amateur stage shows, and their own self-amusement. And beneath this terror and this fringe, what kind of people were there? Who? Genuine aristocrats, career military men, philosophers, scholars, painters, actors, lyceum graduates. Here are a few of the Solovki veterans whose names have been preserved in the memoirs of those who survived. Shirinskaya Shakhmatova, Sheremeteva, Shakovskaya, Fitstum, I.S. Delvig, Bagratuni, Asociani Erisov, Gosheron de la Force, Sivers, G.M. Osorgin, Klot, N.N. Bakhrushin, Aksakov, Komorovsky, P.M. Voyekov, Vadbolsky, Vonyalyarsky, V. Levashov, Ovi Volkov, V. Lodzino-Lozinsky, D. Gudovich, Tauber, V.S. Muromtsev, former cadet leader Nekrasov, was it he? The financier, Professor Odzerov, the jurist, Professor A.B. Borodin, the psychologist, Professor A.P. Sukhanov, the philosophers, Professor A.A. Mayer, Professor S.A. Askoldov, Y.N. Danzaz, the theosophist, Mayobus, the historians, N.P. Ansiferov, M.D. Preselkov, G.O. Gordon, A.I. Zaodzersky, P.G. Vasilyenko, the literary scholars, D.S. Likachev and Zeitlin, the linguist, I.Y. Anichkov, the orientalist, N.V. Pigulevskaya, the ornithologist, G. Polyakov, the artists, Brads and P.F. Smotritsky, the actors, I.D. Kalugin of the Alexandrinka, B. Globakovsky, B.Y. Korolenko, a nephew. In the 30s, near the end of Solovki, Father Pavel A. Florensky was also there. Because of their upbringing, their traditions, they were too proud to show depression or fear, to whine and complain about their fate, even to friends. It was a sign of good manners to take everything with a smile, even while being marched out to be shot. Just as if all this Arctic prison in a roaring sea were simply a minor misunderstanding at a picnic, to joke, to make fun of the jailers. So there was an elephant on the money and in the flower bed. So there was a goat in place of a horse. And if the seventh company was made up of actors, then its company leader had to be Kunst. And if there was a person named Berry Yogoda, then he, of course, had to be the chief of the berry dryer. And that is how those jokes came about which got past the ignoramus censors of the magazine. And those songs, Georgi Mikhailovich Osorgin, used to walk around and mock, Comment vous portez-vous on this island? A lager, comme a lager. And these jokes, this stressed and emphasized independence of the aristocratic spirit, these, more than anything else, irritated the half-beast Solovetsky jailers. One time, Osorgin was scheduled to be shot, and that very day his young wife, and he himself was not yet 40, disembarked on the wharf there. And Osorgin begged the jailers not to spoil his wife's visit for her. He promised that he would not let her stay more than 3 days, and that they could shoot him as soon as she left. And here is the kind of self-control this meant, the sort of thing we have forgotten because of the anathema we have heaped upon the aristocracy, we who whine at every petty misfortune and every petty pain. For 3 days he never left his wife's side, and he had to keep her from guessing the situation. He must not hint at it, even in one single phrase. He must not allow his spirits to quaver. He must not allow his eyes to darken. Just once, his wife is alive, and she remembers it now. When they were walking along the holy lake, she turned and saw that her husband had clutched his head in torment. What's wrong? Nothing, he answered instantly. She could have stayed still longer, but he begged her to leave. As the steamer pulled away from the wharf, he was already undressing to be shot. But still, someone did give them those 3 days. Those 3 Osorgin days, like other cases, show how far the Solovetsky regime was from having donned the armor of a system. The impression is left that the air of Solovki strangely mingled extreme cruelty with an almost benign incomprehension of where all this was leading, which Solovetsky characteristics were becoming the embryo of the great archipelago, and which were destined to dry up and wither in the bud. After all, the Solovetsky Islands people did not yet, generally speaking, firmly believe that the ovens of the Arctic Auschwitz had been lit right there, and that its crematory furnaces had been thrown open to all who were ever brought there. This book is continued on Cassette 2,